Good morning, brothers and sisters. We will continue our studies around the feasts that we started off with such a comprehensive address last night by Brother David on the Feast of Pentecost. And moving through the Israelites' year, we consider this morning the Day of Atonement. So this is the first part of the slide that we want to look at. It's the time of year. The time of year was roughly corresponds to our October time. I don't know how well our chart is coming up, but I think probably most people are familiar with that chart that we have in front of us there on the slide. And we can see that it's somewhere between September and October time in our year was the seventh month, Tishrei, wherein the Day of Atonement fell. It's actually regarded by the Jews as Rosh Hashanah, the head of the year. Brother David mentioned the word Rosh last night, the head. Rosh Hashanah, the head of the year. We've got there the civil year. We know the beginning of the religious year was Abib, when the month of the Passover took place. This is the head of the civil year at that particular time, the seventh month. It was regarded as the greatest day of the year, and as we move through the slides, we probably have an appreciation of that. The day was also considered a Sabbath or a rest in itself. And when we consider, when we've had a part of that reading, I don't know whether we've had time to absorb all the details, but it regarded a longer preparation time than any other of the feasts in the Israelitish calendar. So it was the seventh month of the ecclesiastical year and the first month of the civil year. And I think Brother David hinted at some of the numerical significances of all these things. We don't intend either to go and take a sub sort of study in the numbers, but seven and the first are obviously very significant. The first is a new beginning, and the seventh is the covenant number, also the number of completion. And these thoughts will remain with you perhaps, and you can sort of build up some of your own pictures in your own time when you think about these things, when you read about the Day of Atonement, etc. So moving on to the special occasions in this month. In this seventh month, there were three sort of significant days. The first day of every month, of course, was significant because it was the new moon. And there were special offerings that Brother David referred to yesterday. But the ones in this seventh month was the memorial of the blowing of trumpets. And ideally, we should really spend some time looking at that, but we're not going to this morning. The second was the Day of Atonement, which is the 10th day of the 7th month. And then is the Feast of Tabernacles, which Brother Robert will be speaking on. So we don't need to deal with anything of that at this point in time. So it's the Day of Atonement that we're looking at, but it was introduced particularly by the memorial of the blowing of trumpets on the first day. It was like an introduction. So in a sense, if you look at it in that particular slide, you have the Feast of Trumpets, which was proclaiming a new era. It was a new year beginning, a new civil year at any rate. The Day of Atonement came on that 10th day, which was a season of great trial and of deep penitence for the whole nation of Israel, followed by a period of great joy in the Feast of Tabernacles, which we look forward to hearing a little bit later, which was a period of blessing for the people. But first, that Day of Atonement, which is significant, of course. Now, in the book, Faith in the Last Days, which is taken from the Herald, Brother Thomas has a section which probably most of you are familiar with. It's on page 117. He has the Day of Atonement. And in that article, which is really, really interesting, he seems to combine what can be proved from the scripture, chapter and verse, and what also appears to me, details taken perhaps from rabbinical writings or the Talmud or whatever it is, but and he kind of combines it together, because reading through the article I can sort of like put chapter and verse on some of them, but I can't get chapter and verse on others, and this might be illustrated as we go along. But the very least, if you haven't read that article, please read it. It's a very good article and really emphasizes what happened on the Day of Atonement, and this particular chart which we've given out is basically an emphasis of that. I might come to that chart a little bit later depending on my time. So basically, what Brother Thomas does in that article, he says from the first day, when he had the blowing of trumpets, to the seventh day, he said there were days of conversion where the people turned to Yahweh to begin this preparation process ready for the Day of Atonement. Eighth and ninth were regarded, he says, as terrible days, when the people clothed themselves with sackcloth and began to afflict their souls. And you probably, I'm not quite sure it's in their introductory reading where it said, ye shall afflict your souls. If it wasn't there, it certainly is recorded in Numbers chapter 29. Ye shall afflict your souls. And then the fast began from the sunset on the 9th going through to the 10th, the Day of Atonement, Yom HaKippurim. We're pretty much familiar with Yom Kippur because we know in 1973 the Arabs and Egypt and Syria made that surprise attack on the children of Israel, the people of Israel in the land, and it was known as the Yom Kippur War, Yom HaKippurim. I think Har is the definite article. The Day of Atonement, or maybe it's the Day of the Atonement. Brother Ewan perhaps can give us some details of where that definite article fits in there afterwards. So that's our Brother Thomas, and I thought it was kind of interesting because whichever way you want to look at it, leading up to the Day of Atonement, for the seriously minded, the sober-minded Israelite, that Day of Atonement would mean a lot. It would be appropriate to be prepared for that day. So what was the day all about for Israel? Now, Brother David hinted, no, he didn't hint it, he said it in a very strong language actually last night. He said that the feasts were characterized by bloodshedding. And he said, I think he said anyway, that you could take any day of Israel's year and it would be characterized by bloodshedding because you had the continual burnt offering. A lamb was burnt in the morning, a lamb was offered in the evening, along with the trimming of the lamps and the offering of incense morning and evening. The lamb was offered morning and evening. So the principle of sacrifice was embodied in the life cycle of the children of Israel, if they were to stop and think about it. But they were also, as Leviticus chapters 1 to 5, or thereabouts, show that they were various offerings, not just the burnt offering, and not just the meal offering, or the peace offering, which the children of Israel might offer voluntarily, but they were also the sin offerings and the trespass offerings. When the children of Israel had committed sins of ignorance, or where they had committed a trespass against Yahweh or against their fellow man, they would have to offer. But, you know, there would be times, especially when you think about the sin of ignorance, you might never really come to realize that something you had done was wrong. So there might be many times during the course of a year where you might have committed a sin and you might have been totally ignorant of it. And even though you might be a very sincere Israelite, very fastidious, looking very closely at your actions, at your words, at your thoughts, it might well be that you would not be aware of something during the course of the year. And it may be ceremonial defilement. You might have touched something which was defiling, a dead body, a bone, or something like that. The Israelitish law was so comprehensive that it was quite possible for you to become defiled. So many offences that were designed to teach Israel about sin would have gone unforgiven during the course of a year. And each member of the children of Israel, when it came to the Day of Atonement, this was really designed for them to express their own remorse individually and their desire for forgiveness. The Hengod Ecclesia has been recently going through the Law of Moses, and we have been struck via the writings of Brother Roberts of just how fastidious the whole law was and how comprehensive it was in looking at the everyday life of the children of Israel. You couldn't even have a child without the ceremonial defilement. So the children of Israel ought, if they were faithful, to be very, very conscious of sin. It was all taking them back right to Genesis 3 and the introduction of sin into the world and the shedding of blood that was necessary for the clothing of Adam and Eve. So even though there were a huge amount of sacrifices during the year, there might well have been many defilements, many uncleannesses. And so, by one act, Israel's sins were forgiven as a nation on the Day of Atonement, by this one act. That's what the Day of Atonement principally was designed to do. So, Brother Grocott, I haven't recorded where I read it, but he's got an article in Be Transformed, I think it's volume 2, he described it as the great yearly occasion of cleansing and reconciling to God. The great principles of the scriptures, amongst others, teaches us that sin alienates us naturally from God. God is holy and righteous, and sin brought a rupture between the harmony that existed in the Garden of Eden between the deity and man. Brother Grocott said, the scriptures then talk about cleansing and reconciliation. And he said, on that great yearly occasion, that is what it was all about. Brother Thomas in Faith in the Last Day says, the sins of the whole Jewish nation were covered over. So, all through the year then, Israel had brought their individual offerings and trespasses for sin and trespass, but, we put a but in there, this annual feast brought home how insufficient those personal offerings had been to take away sin. You know, if you were doing it every day, you might think, well, there's no need for anything else. But the Day of Atonement was really showing to the children of Israel, look, that's not sufficient. You need a great day to cleanse you from your sin and to reconcile you to God. So the law, with the huge amounts of teachings, which we could spend many, many addresses on, was basically still focusing the children of Israel's minds to the inadequacy of what they were doing. And this, hopefully, by the time we finish our address, this will come out as well. So this annual feast was not even effective in its entirety. Not that you might... Yes, I think the faithful Israel would have, but you might not think it at first sight until we read the words of the Apostle Paul, written up there in Hebrews 10, where it says, but in those sacrifices there is a remembrance again made of sins every year. So it wasn't sufficient to do your daily sin offerings, your trespass offerings. You had to have an annual feast. But that annual feast was repetitive. The next year you did the same thing, and the year after you did the same thing. The only difference might be is that the high priest might have changed, because the previous high priest might have died, and his son, the elect, the high priest, would take his place. But year on year, the Day of Atonement took place. The answer is why, we have to flag this verse up, because I didn't put it down there, but in verse 4 of Hebrews chapter 10, there's no connection between an animal's blood and man's transgression. Animals didn't sin in the Garden of Eden. Man did. So in a sense, it was a substitutionary order of things. Because be it a bullock, be it a ram, be it a lamb, they didn't commit sin. So this was really pointing forward to something else, to something greater, as we know. So the Day of Atonement was all about sin. It was all about holiness. And it's all about cleansing. Sin is obvious to the mind trained in the divine pattern. Sin and transgression and defilement become obvious. And the children of Israel ought to have been able to see that in their everyday lives in the law. And what they ought to have seen, and they ought to have seen it by the consideration of the high priest, was the desire for holiness, for separateness, for a clean way of life in thought, word and deed. The high priest represented the nation as a whole, stood for holiness, stood for righteousness. He was God's representative to the nation. And all the sacrifices, cleansing, and particularly on that one great day. So the word atonement that we read in our Bibles in the King James versions comes from that word kippur. And Strong defines it as expiation from kafar. Kafar means to cover, make an atonement. And I've underlined this one, cleanse, because we had quite a discussion in the Bible class some months ago upon this word, kafar, or kippur, and what it did actually mean. Strong actually puts in his concordance that it could actually, and has been, I think, rendered cleanse. It means disannul, forgive, purge away. Those are some of the ideas that Strong gives in his concordance, which, keeping that word cleanse in mind, and Brother Grocott, as we know, makes a very strong point about the word cleansing, and he does so in Be Transformed, Volume 3, page 25, which is probably the previous references from that article as well. He says the basic meaning of cleanse, beside the basic meaning of cleanse, the Hebrew word carried the idea of cover. So we've got the both ideas coming to our minds here, cleanse and covering, covering of sins, and we know the word kapor, or kafar, I'm not quite sure which was used, when the ark was covered in the days of Noah, there was this covering over. Brother Grocott says, and if you look at some of these scriptures, which we put at the bottom of that slide, Leviticus 16:30, Hebrews 9, Apocalypse, I mean, we'd like to turn some of these scriptures up, but hopefully We can do in the course of the day and discuss these things, but if I turn them all up now, I'm just going to lose a little bit of time and not get through what I need to get to. So this idea of cleansing and cleanness, Brother Grocott says, makes up the great theme of the scriptures. This idea of cleansing and being clean before God. So continuing our thinking about what was the day all about. Well, if we were to read the details in Leviticus chapter 16, towards the end of the chapter, and in Numbers 29, we find that there are quite a number of points. It says it was an holy convocation, and the Hebrew means to call out. It's a calling together of the people. So the people of Israel were really needed to be gathered together. I think that word convocation, that word mikra, whichever it's pronounced, is the New Testament equivalent of ecclesia. And we are here today as an ecclesia. We're called out of the world. So the body of the children of Israel for this Day of Atonement were going to be called together. And on that particular day, we're specifically told it was a day to afflict your souls. And if you followed the reading that Brother David gave us, it basically said anyone who didn't afflict their souls would be cut off. There was also to be an offering made by fire. Offer an offering made by fire. So it's a strange thing, but it was the high priest, as we hope to show, that actually did the offerings, but the children of Israel were closely associated with that offering because they were gathered together in this holy convocation. They were told to afflict their souls, and they were said to make an offer an offering made by fire. Though it wasn't they who did it, in a sense, the high priest, as we said, was their representative. So in a larger thought concept, they were involved then and were taking part in that day. They were also to do no servile work therein, and it says basically those who did servile work were to be destroyed. I think that was what we read earlier on, but we could check these out. So if they were to afflict their souls, if they were to do servile work, this would not be acceptable. This was a specific day, which was to be a holy day, and they had to think very carefully about it. They had to afflict their souls. The high priest couldn't do it for them. It was they as individuals had to come prepared to that Day of Atonement, having afflicted their souls and making sure they didn't do any particular work that day, because it was regarded as a Sabbath of rest. So Aaron, on this day, what was this day all about? Aaron was actually going to make an atonement for himself and his household. He was also going to make it for a congregation. You might want to put one and two together. There has been a suggestion that Christ sacrificed for himself, for his household, his apostles, and the congregation, maybe the whole of the Jews and Gentiles brought into the fold, as it were. Be that as it may, there was one other thing that we could not avoid by looking at Leviticus 16. He also made an atonement for the tabernacle. So himself and his household, the congregation as a whole, and also for the tabernacle. So, what were the requirements on that day? That's what he had to do. That was what the day was all about. This national occasion. But what would actually require? What did he physically have to do? Well, as we've said, there were sacrifices for Aaron and his house. And that was a sin offering and a burnt offering. He had to take a bullock and he had to take a burnt offering. And they were for himself and his house. There was also then, separately, a sacrifice for the nation. And that was a sin offering and a burnt offering as well. The sin offering consisted of two kids of the goat, and the burnt offering consisted of a ram. The two kids of the goat is interesting because we have, which forms part of the uniqueness of that day, the scapegoat. One of the goats was slain, and the other, after having Aaron's both hands laid upon his head, bearing, we're told, the iniquities of Israel's iniquities, the goat was then sent away into the wilderness. The goat was sent, and we possibly should underline this on the slide, outside the camp. So Aaron's going to offer the bullock and the ram for himself. He's going to offer the ram for the people of Israel, but also there's these two kids of the goat. One is sent off alive into the wilderness, the other one was slain. It's a unique position, that. It's the only similarity that we see under the law was in the cleansing of the leper, where there were two birds. One was slain and one was let go free, sort of thing. So we have this uniqueness about this day because we have this scapegoat. When an animal was normally brought to the tabernacle, it was normally sacrificed. This is an occasion where an animal went free, went forth alive. But as Brother David brought out to us yesterday, there were also sacrifices on the day because it was known as a holy convocation. If we read Numbers chapter 29, the day was regarded as a holy convocation, a special time when they were gathered together, just like David brought out at the Feast of Pentecost. This was also a time when there was a special day, and on these special days there were additional feasts. If you read Leviticus chapter 16, which is the first introduction that we have in the Law of Moses to the Day of Atonement, you read about the two goats, you read about the two rams, and you read about the bullock. But you don't read these ancillary offerings. These were additional to the sacrifices of the day. Incidentally, just it strikes me at the moment, if anybody is struggling to write everything down, I'm quite happy to print the slides off, or give you a copy of the slide if anybody, the whole PowerPoint if anybody wants them. So the additional sacrifice on these days was the bullock, the ram, the lambs, seven lambs, and one kid of the goats. And Numbers says, beside the sin of a goat for atonement. So that appears to be my calculation of the amount of offerings on that day. Those who have heard me talk about the Day of Atonement will realise that I have had enormous difficulty in trying to reconcile the amount of sacrifices that took place on that day. Because, you can see I've underlined the 16 as a total there. Brother Thomas, and I'm going to put a slide up to show exactly what Brother Thomas says in a few moments from that article in Faith in the Last Days. He said there were 15 victims of that day. And I've really been at a really difficulty to try and get it to 15. We know there was one bullock and a ram for Aaron. And we know there was one ram and one goat that were offered for the nation. On that holy convocation, there were seven lambs, one goat, one ram and a bullock. Plus on that day, there were the continual burnt offerings. The one burnt in the morning and the one burnt in the evening. So to me, that totals 16. Now I'm not really sure how we get to 15, but I'd be interested if anybody can actually explain how that actually works. So that's the calculation that we got it then. So on. The other thing which is really interesting on this day is that the high priest entered the most holy place. There was no other occasion during the course of the year where entrance into that part of the tabernacle or the temple was admissible. You entered that on pain of death. But on the Day of Atonement, the high priest was able to enter in. He did so first of all with incense. is it verse 13? These are references from Leviticus 16. So he takes incense, as if the incense was a cloud that covered the Shekinah glory that dwelt over the cherubim. He then later went in with the blood of the bullock, and we run through the sequence very quickly in a few moments. He went in with the blood of the bullock. He'd slain the bullock, and he now takes the bullock in with the blood of the bullock in. He then goes back out and gets and slays the goat, and takes the blood of the goat in with him into the most holy place. And the suggestion is, though I must admit, I can't get a verse to fix on that. I can see verse 13, 14 and 15 is indicating the first, second and third entrances perhaps, but I can't really find a verse where the high priest actually goes in at the conclusion of the sacrifices to bring out the incense. If anybody can help me on that one, that would be really interesting, and it might be a good point of discussion. Brother Thomas makes the point that he goes in, and it seems logical that you would actually go back in after you've done the various sacrifices, you've done the sprinkling on and before the mercy seat. It would seem appropriate that you might wash your hands and go back in at another point in time to bring the incense back out. Put the curtain back, because if you remember, the curtain would be removed and the holy and most holy would become one place on that day only. And you would go back in, you would take the incense from the holy place, or whatever point it was put, and put the curtain back, and then leave. So, what is the meaning? And you know, like Brother David, I'm going to take kind of the soft option, much to do with time more than anything else as well, in not really spending huge amounts of time in looking at each individual offering. But for the children of Israel, they would really look at the bullock as a very important animal. It was more important than a lamb, for example. It was a bigger beast. It would have been more valuable, and it was a bullock that the high priest used for the sin offering. It would represent the strength and labour and productiveness, because they would be used in the field. It wasn't a goat, and we're going to make this point, I think, in a couple of slides on. It wasn't a goat that the high priest used, because the goat would indicate waywardness. There's no implication of waywardness in the bullock. He's a faithful labourer for you. If you own a bullock and that particular breed, as it were, then they're faithful labourers. They're steady, reliable, and strong. That was the bullock that the high priest offered for himself. The ram would also symbolise strength, which the high priest offered for a burnt offering. As we said, the goat represented the waywardness of mankind and disobedience. You don't notice, apparently, the difference too much between a lamb and a goat when they're young, but the goat does have those characteristics of being wayward. Lambs, we're all familiar with lambs. They're meek, they're gentle. They're described by Brother Roberts and others as innocent. So the children of Israel would, if they had sat down and thought about it and not looked at it as a mechanical ritual, they would have seen in all these offerings in the day of Solomon these aspects of, you know, giving one strength to God, maybe, you know, being innocent and gentle, not having perhaps the waywardness of the goat, all these thoughts perhaps, or should have been in the mind of the faithful man or woman who lived in Israel, as when we do our readings, they should be in our minds. There was an order of sacrifice. There was a sin offering first, and then the burnt offering came afterwards. What is also unique about this is the work of the high priest. If the scapegoat was sort of unique about that day, then so too was the work of the high priest, because we've already hinted at it. He alone was able to go into the most holy place. Here, he performed all the functions of the ordinary priests. So on this particular day, the ordinary priests were almost redundant. They were not able to do the work of the high priest. Now, obviously, yes, they literally could. But the law said, God said, no, they cannot. This is a day for the high priest alone. And of course, it was teaching very forcibly greater lessons, which we'll look at, God willing, shortly. But so the high priest was a lone figure. The busy tabernacle was not busy anymore. The priests who could have gone in and out of the holy place were absent. Brother Grocott describes him as this lone figure, all on his own, carrying out these functions. He wore the linen garments of the ordinary priests. We're very familiar with the high priest's garments, with the breastplate, with the 12 stones, and the ephod, and also on this day. And I know this is not controversial, that would be the wrong word. This is a matter for discussion, and we are happy to discuss it. But while I had some doubt in my mind to a large extent, I don't feel I have much doubt in my own mind personally now that he had the linen garments. He did not go in with his full regalia on, with the bells and the pomegranates. And it was Brother Richard Lister, actually, in a discussion on this, said to me, do you think bells would sound made of gold? And I stopped and thought about it, and I thought, well, no, you don't get too much of a sound from bells made of gold. Be that as it may, I leave that thought with you. I'm fairly comfortable in my own mind that he had the garments of the ordinary priests, which is what Brother Grocott actually wrote in his article on the Day of Atonement. He He performed the functions of the ordinary priest. He wore the linen garments of the ordinary priest. And on that day only, he entered into the most holy place. Now, this is actually the slide I said I would put up, where Brother Thomas referred to the work of our high priest on that day. And if you haven't read that article, it's well worth reading it. Hopefully we'll be able to bring out, even the course of these remarks, in some detail. But sometimes you need to really sit down and think about it in the quietness of your own homes. The huge amount of work that high priest must have had on that day. Brother Thomas said he would have slain, divided, and washed and offered 15 victims. He would wash his body 5 times. I was able to reconcile that, I think. Wash his hands and feet 10 times. I really couldn't reconcile that 10 times. And change his garment 6 times. I was kind of able to follow the logic there as well. And yes, entering the most holy place 4 times. This I'm not going to go through this particular handout. I just did it, and I tried to do it from Faith in the Last Days, and just to try and follow through, to try and see how it, from the dawn of the day, what he would have done from the beginning of his day, putting off his garments that he might have got up in, and then immersing his whole body, then putting on holy garments, and the various things during the course of that day. And it's my attempt to try and follow the article in Faith in the Last Days to a large extent, and also to put in, and I put them in with question marks, where, like washing hands and feet, it might be just washing hands and not feet at certain points in time. But it struck me that if there were so many sacrifices, you could well become covered in blood when the knife is going to be going down the animal, cutting the jugular vein. You're going to get blood on your hands. So there's some suggestions in this, and I wouldn't want anyone walking away thinking this is like, you know, an actual action of the high priest. But I think what it does do when you stop and you actually work it out, even if some of the points in there may not be correct, there's something like about 58 specific actions during the course of that day, a lot of it which would have involved very muscular work in killing an animal, cutting it up, sacrificing it. I think what it does, it gives us some idea of the huge amount of work and responsibility that high priest had. It all depended on him. The weight of this holy day rested firmly and squarely upon the shoulders of the high priest. He couldn't have anybody to take over from him. He couldn't say to somebody else, could you do this particular offering? I'm really feeling a little bit tired at the moment. Everything had to be done by him. It had to be done correctly, meticulously, without deviation, as Brother David emphasized to us last night. The whole weight, and I think this, amongst other things, I suppose, but this is the one great factor that comes out of that. We can read through the chapter of Leviticus 16, and we don't really get the picture. And I think Brother Thomas included in that one in Faith and Art, he really does show the huge amount of work. The high priest must have been absolutely shattered by the end of that day with what he had to accomplish. It was all on his shoulders to make sure that day was carried out in accordance with God's requirements. So, these are where I can put the verses on in verse 3 of Leviticus 16. I don't know whether you want to turn the chapter up. I'm not going to turn my chapter up because I've listed them down, but you might want to follow him through in your own Bibles. He comes into the holy place with the bullock and the ram. He washes his flesh with water. He puts on the linen garments. He takes 2 kids of the goats and a ram, and then he slays the bullock in verse 6. He presents the goats before Yahweh, and then he casts lots to see which one is to be sacrificed and which one is to go free. He takes a censer full of burning coals in verse 12, and his hands then full of incense, he brings that in within the veil for his first entrance into the most holy place. He then comes back out to pick up the blood of the bullock. He's already slain the bullock before he goes in with the incense. He's slain the bullock. One suggestion that I think Brother Thomas makes in Faith in the Last Days, and I'm not sure about this, it's certainly not in the scriptures as I can see, he said he would have had somebody to stir the blood to stop it coagulating. I'm not sure about that point. because I feel that it probably was just the high priest alone. But anyway, he comes out for the blood of the bullock, and he goes back into the holy place for the second time and sprinkles the blood before the mercy seat and on the mercy seat. Upon it, it says, and before the mercy seat, seven times in the garments of the ordinary priests. Then he comes back out, he slays the kid of the goats, in verse 15, and goes back into the most holy place for the third time, and sprinkles the blood of the goat as he did with the blood of the bullock. So, the high priest in doing this then makes atonement for the holy place. That's what it says in verse 16, he shall make atonement of the holy place because of the uncleanness of the children of Israel and because of their transgressions and all their sins. And this is something that we have to stop and think about. And we pick up a slide a little bit later, not too later, that these were what we'll describe as inanimate objects. He's sprinkling them on the mercy seat and before the mercy seat. He also makes atonement for the altar. I find it a little bit difficult to read again, but I think it's the altar of incense that he's talking about there. And it says in Leviticus, with the blood of the bullock and the goat. And Brother Thomas, although I don't think you can pick this up in Leviticus 16, he said the blood of the bullock and the blood of the lamb would be mixed together, and then the blood would be sprinkled upon the altar. So the altar itself, because of the sins of the children of Israel, it says, was also cleansed by the blood of the bull and goat. So this almost like we might say ritual, was basically cleansing, not just individuals, it was cleansing the actual tabernacle itself, which we will look at that a little bit later. So the priest, as it says in verse 20, makes reconciliation with Kaphar. He reconciles the holy place, the tabernacle, and the altar. Then leaves the tabernacle. And you might have already thought of that verse in Hebrews, which I hope we'll be looking at shortly. Almost all things are by the law purged with blood. Then he leaves the tabernacle. He then lays his hands upon the head of the live goat, confesses over him the iniquities of the children of Israel, and sends him away to the hand of a fit man into the wilderness. And it's not fit to someone, as we understand, someone who's very healthy. I think the marginal, or one of the reasons, is a timeless man, one who's there at the right time. And we'll come back and look at that at the type if we've got time. Then he puts off the linen garments, verse 23. He washes his flesh, verse 24. He puts on his garments, and he offers his ram and the people's ram for the burnt offering in verse 24. And the fat of the sin offering is burnt on the altar, verse 25. We put in brackets there the golden garments. When it says in verse 24, put on his garments, I believe it's at that point he puts on his golden garments. Because he said he actually takes off his garments and leaves them in the holy place. And then he puts on, it says, his garments. And it doesn't kind of distinguish which garments he's talking about. I'd like to suggest that he puts on his golden garments at that point. And I think that's what Brother Thomas says in that article in Faith in the Last Days. Now at the completion of the day, the skin, the flesh, and the dung of the bullock and the goat for the sin offerings were burnt. And we've underlined this point, without the camp. The high priest came forth and pronounced a blessing upon the people of Israel. And we put in brackets, or otherwise. It depended upon the state of Israel whether he would bless them or not. And in a faithful environment where the children of Israel are living in accordance with God's plan, God's precepts, then I would suggest that via Urim and Thummim, maybe, there was an indication that the high priest would have known whether to pronounce a blessing or a curse. And once in 50 years, there would have been the Jubilee, which Brother Steve would speak about, when the trumpet would sound. That was once in 50 years, at the end of the Day of Atonement. So at some point, the high priest then, as we said, went back into the most holy place to retrieve the incense, and the curtain would be closed, and that would be the end of the most holy place entrance for another year. Now then, hopefully what we've been able to do, at least in part, is to show what the day was about for Israel and the various offerings that would take part on that day, and also what the high priest did, and the huge, I feel I haven't emphasised enough really the work of the high priest, but hopefully at your own time you can meditate upon these things to think about the huge amount of responsibility that he had. So, types and shadows. I've picked out, and we can do this from probably many different ways, just four aspects there. The unique features of the day, the limitations of the law. The book of the Hebrews expounds. I'm really hoping I can pick up the book of Hebrews and we can turn our scriptures up and look at some of the verses there. And a summary of the types. So, the three significant features of this day. We've already made reference to the fact that the high priest was there in white garments. He wore the garments of the ordinary priests when he was performing the main functions of the Day of Atonement. And he entered into the most holy place. That would never happen on any other day. And there was also this aspect of the scapegoat. Now, to be honest, if you wanted to analyse it further, you could say, well, there's about four or five, I think, special features of that day. I've just made reference to three there. The white garments speak of righteousness. The most holy place, as you know, because you'll have read in Hebrews many times, refers to heaven itself, to pick up the phrase of Paul in Hebrews. And the live goat is the principle of resurrection. Now then, these white garments, we've emphasized quite a lot that he performed the functions of the ordinary priests. And I think the lesson is quite powerful when you think about that. And I think this is why Brother Grocott had it in the exhortation that he wrote, and which is incorporated in Be Transformed. He took upon him the nature of Adam, the same nature of his brethren, so that when he went and performed these functions, in the full knowledge of the other priests, in the full knowledge of the children of Israel, at least the Israelite who would have any interest in these things and would have at least asked about them if they hadn't actually been able to see them, they would have realized that this most important day of the year was carried out not with the most important garments on, but with the garments of the ordinary priests. And you and I know what that means. For us, Hebrews 2 verse 14, one of these powerful verses in the book of Hebrews, that for as much then as the children are partakers of flesh and blood, he also himself likewise. And I think that verse shows the power of the King James Version over all the modern versions. He also himself likewise. I think the King James does a huge service to us in emphasizing the fact that Christ had the same nature of those he came to save. That through death he might destroy him that had the power of death, that is the devil. The functions of the high priest on that day were carried out in the garments of the ordinary priest. Christ came in the same nature as ourselves. And we know this is the huge controversies that are in Christadelphia on this, whereas these and other things teach the pure truth of the nature and sacrifice of Christ. These white garments also would have taught, however, the perfect character of righteousness. It was to be performed by a sinless man. We made the point earlier that the high priest for himself did not offer a goat. The goat was offered for the children of Israel because human nature is wayward. It's faltering, it fails, it sins. But that was not the offering for the high priest. Christ was not wayward. His character was perfect. And I took this from Smith's Dictionary. I thought it was well expressed here. In his Smith's Dictionary, it says, the high priest wearing those white garments was the best outward type which a living man could present in his own person of that pure and holy one who was to purify his people and to cleanse them from their sins. I thought that was well indicated. The righteousness of Christ was shown by by those white garments that he wore on that particular day. For we have not an high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but is in all points tempted like us we are, yet without sin. That combines the both. The fact that he came in our nature, yes, feeling of our infirmities, but without sin. Perfect. Into heaven itself, that other unique point, the Day of Atonement allowed the high priest to go into the most holy place once a year. And by that, the children of Israel was really being shown that the tabernacle was really a shadow of good things to come. It was a prophecy that approach to God was yet to be accomplished. and we know that Christ entered into heaven itself. Seeing then that we have a great high priest that is passed into the heavens, Paul says in Hebrews 4, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our profession. And in chapter 6, we have a hope as an anchor of the soul, sure and steadfast, and which entereth into that within the veil, whither the forerunner for us is entered, even Jesus made a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So Jesus has entered into the veil, even into heaven itself. Quick point on the live goat. Yes, this was unique for that day. All of the sacrifices usually found that they were slain and offered. But here, there was one of the animals which was brought to the tabernacle which actually went free. And Brother Grocott says there were practically no symbols of resurrection or of life after death in the law. And he makes this phrase, resurrection was a step beyond the law. But here on the Day of Atonement, you could see that resurrection was taught by the live goat going away, as it were. It wasn't sacrifice. And Brother Grocott also makes the point, Christ's death did not in itself complete the redeeming work. And Paul says that Jesus was delivered for our offences and was raised again for our justification. And he also says in chapter 5, verse 10 of Romans, when we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his Son. Much more being reconciled, we shall be saved by his life. And that is his resurrection, we put in brackets there. We know in the errors of Central, they make the aspect to do his life prior to his death. But we know that that is teaching his resurrection, which shows the power of his death and resurrection. The other thing that we have is the limitations of the law. We made the point that we record the Day of Atonement on Leviticus chapter 16, which is closely followed after the events of, I think it's Leviticus chapter 10, where Nadab and Abihu were slain at the very time they were to complete the consecration of the priests. At the very time when the consecration of the priests was to be fulfilled and the tabernacle services were to begin, they brought strange fire. Bang! Yahweh destroyed them because they had deviated from what was required. And it taught a great lesson that the Aaronic priesthood would fail to provide eternal redemption. It was flawed. So although there was a disobedience in Nadab and Abihu, it did point the fact that there was limitations to the law. The sacrifices as well on that Day of Atonement, even though it was a great day, the completion of the sacrifice was outside the camp. It was burnt outside the camp. Teaching again that even though that was the great day of the year, yet outside the very place where the whole centre, the nerve centre, the heart throb of the nation was the tabernacle or the temple, and yet outside of it, the day was completed by the sacrifices being burnt. Not all of it, the fat was burnt on the altar, but the completion of that day, it was outside the camp. So there was a need for a greater priesthood. For those priests, Paul says, were made without an oath, but with an oath by him that said unto him, the Lord swear and will not repent, thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. He has an unchangeable priesthood. We made this point that there may be one difference from one year to another. He might have been a different priest, the other priest had died. The priesthood of Christ, described as the Melchizedek priesthood, was an unchanging one. It was a better testament that Jesus died under. There were many priests because they were not suffered to continue by reason of death, but this man, because he continueth ever, hath an unchangeable priesthood, and therefore he's able to save to the uttermost. So I'm going to have to run through these a little bit quickly. And again, you followed my train of thought earlier when I was really emphasising the fact of the work that depended on Christ, on the high priest. It all pointed forward to Christ. Everything depended upon Christ. His whole life, his whole work for the Father was like a heavy weight on his shoulders. If he deviated once, if his thoughts had strayed into sin, even once, the whole scheme of redemption would have fallen. Just one sinful thought, and everything would have gone. There was no perfect sacrifice. What a weight to be upon this one man who single-handedly followed the principles of God's law. So the ordinances of the day were a prophecy of Christ's work of redemption. He was the better sacrifice. And there's a quotation from Brother Robert. There must therefore be a sense in which Christ, the antitypical Aaron, antitypical altar, mercy seat, everything, must not only have been sanctified by the action of the antitypical oil of the Holy Spirit, but purged by the antitypical blood of his own sacrifice. The fact that the mercy seat, the altar, the tabernacle was purged with blood shows most powerfully that Christ himself, who was the antitype unquestionably of all these things, needed a blood cleansing sacrifice, needed to be purged from sin, not his own personal commitment of sin, but from the sin nature which he bore. It would serve us well in the days in which we live to even emphasize these points even further, but I don't think we've got time. So he offered for himself, and that blood was sprinkled 7 times. It was the complete purging, the complete sacrifice. This was it. This is what everything in the law pointed to, and it was completed in Christ. We're going to make some references to the sin offering and the burnt offering, taking some quotes from Brother Groper, but we're not going to have time to deal with that, or the meal offering, or the drink offerings. And we're not going to have time to look up these scriptures. I wanted to look up Hebrews 9 and 10 because it shows in Hebrews 9 verses 2 to 3 and 6 to 10 that the tabernacle was a prophecy that approach to God was yet to be accomplished. And it makes that wonderful point in Hebrews 9 verses 12 as well, that you know that Christ he sacrificed, and it says for himself, and we know that that for himself is in italics, which isn't there in the original, and those who understand English much better than myself said it's in the middle voice of the verb, important a thing done to oneself. So the fact that the high priest under the law was offering for himself had its counterpart in Christ after offering for himself. Christ's sacrifice was for himself, to purge the nature which he bore, though he had not committed sins himself. So verse 13 shows the contrast in verse 14 of those chapters between animal sacrifices, which had the power for ceremonial cleansing only, but Christ was able to purge the conscience. He was the antitypical mercy seat purged by his own blood. Please, if you have the time, turn up those verses. The time is actually gone. I would have liked to have gone through those verses because there's some very, very powerful points which pull the whole of the Day of Atonement and bring it to a focus in Christ to be able to see it. Even to the point of Christ suffering outside the walls of Jerusalem. That's where Christ made that grace offering for sin. It was outside the walls of Jerusalem. And these are the summary of the types which we really haven't got time to go through now. So the lessons and exhortations for us, as Brother David said, we do need exhortations and lessons. The Feast of Trumpet proclaimed a new era. This is a slide I put on earlier. I've added a couple of points onto it. We know we're living in the days of the seventh trumpet. And verse 1 Thessalonians 4 said, the trumpet shall sound and the dead in Christ shall rise. And we will meet the Lord in the air. The Day of Atonement is the great time when we are called to the judgment seat of Christ. The Feast of Tabernacles comes afterwards. There's going to be a period of great joy because salvation has been obtained by the great sacrifice of Christ. There's a period of great joy. But first, there's the judgment seat that we have to go through before we get to that period of joy. So in those, you've seen that slide before as well, and you've seen that one as well. I was going to reintroduce it to start talking about a little bit about it. It's a holy calling. We're a holy people. We've been called out of the world of darkness to be a separate people. And that word anah, that word afflicting our souls, means to look down in humility, and it involves fasting. Because fasting relieves the body of the work of digestion and the mind becomes clearer and we're able to concentrate. It's really speaking to us from abstinence from the things of the flesh, abstinence from sin and all the wickedness of this world, physical fasting, a denial of the flesh, mental fasting, reviewing of past conduct in the light of Yahweh's commandments. We're living in the verge of being of the Day of Atonement for us becoming a reality. What an opportunity for us now then, in those days, those terrible days, the days of fasting where we are to afflict our souls, to remember our past conduct, not to morbidly go over our failings, but to remember our frame, as it were. Not just to just remember, but with a determination to follow the principles of righteousness in our lives, to follow that which is right, that which is holy, just and good. We haven't really got time to that. And I think really the principle is there in saying that we have to cease from our own works if we were to turn up really Hebrews 4 verse 10 to see the idea of a Sabbath. So, resting from sin, devoting our time to meditation on the Word of God, and reminding ourselves also from the deliverance of Egypt. Because when the Sabbath was kept, it was also a reminder of their deliverance from Egypt as well. So we will just finish up our thoughts here on the fact that when the various sacrifices had been completed on the Day of Atonement, the high priest would come forth clothed in garments of glory and beauty to pronounce a blessing or otherwise upon the children of Israel. And that's the position we're in now. This is a point that I would like to develop a little bit further. That's the position we're in now. We are, as it were, waiting for the high priest, who's in the most holy, as it were, to come out. Jesus is returning from heaven to come forth with a blessing or otherwise. He will come forth, and that soon, in glory and beauty. The question for us is, will he pronounce a blessing on us?